Well, good evening, and this is Perry Hoffman, and I'm president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, and we're delighted to have you all join us for our second year of our call-in series. So we're very excited to be kicking off this first call-in series with Kelly Kerner and Charlie Swenson, who have returned back with us to be doing Connecting the Dots, and they will start off our season and come with us once a month, so we're very, very appreciative of that. We also have Dr. Jim Brailing, formerly from the National Institute of Mental Health, who will be moderating most of our call-in series and is with us tonight to do that for this first call-in. Most of you I know have been on the calls before, and you have written in how much you enjoy the Connecting the Dots. So I think I will turn it over to Jim, and just so Jim can say hello to everybody, and then we'll let Kelly and Charlie start.
Jim? Hi, everybody. This is Jim Brailing. Really glad to have you. I was blown away by the registrations before this first session, well over 100 and approaching 200, which is just fantastic, and it's great to see that this is meeting such a need and having such interest. I tell you, next week we will begin the research sessions for the fall, and Jenny McPhee, who is a young investigator at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, will be talking about the pioneering work that she has been doing with an NIMH research grant on borderline mothers and their children, ranging from toddlers to adolescents. And this is a very fascinating work with some qualifications about, in this research, there's no way to untangle the genetic factors. But she is a very gifted researcher, and I think people will find it fascinating. And there's something that we will cover later in November with Tim Troll. We will get into the genetics of borderline, and one of the exciting new studies that has come out that in a longitudinal twin design that allows untangling genetic influences over time, looked at the relationship to childhood stress and abuse and maltreatment to emergence of borderline at age 24. And there's some very interesting findings in that that I think will, if it's replicated, will certainly change the conceptions in the field. So, and there's others coming, and also in the new year. So I think it'll be a very exciting session. But let me stop talking and get our master clinicians up at the plate here.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Hi, Jim. Thank you. I appreciate that you can do this. Jim, have you listened to any of these before?
Yes, I have. I just didn't know exactly where you were at this point.
Right, yeah. Well, we never know either at the beginning. Right, Kelly? Kelly and I have not spoken because we've kind of got a flow going in these, and we find that we pick a topic and then we think about it, and then we get on not knowing what the other one's going to talk about, which leads me to be most curious, what's Kelly going to talk about? We left this one just, I think the way this topic came about was I brought up to Kelly when we were just talking about topics that that I thought it'd be interesting. In my own work, I do a fair amount of talking with individuals who receive treatment, not just my own clients, but other people in the public sector mental health system, and how it's been to be in DBT over the years and helped develop self-help groups and things like that, as well as families. And there's just a lot of critique of DBT that comes up, sometimes probably not DBT that's really been done at an expert level, but a lot of critique of DBT that doesn't get represented. But we decided we didn't want to just have a topic of critiquing DBT, but we broadened it to talk about perspectives on DBT that we've each had. So you know what, Kelly, having spoken a little bit, I have some perspectives I'm coming at this from, but I wonder if I could ask you, like, where has your thinking gone about this?
Yeah. You know, I've been coming at this primarily as a person who's interested in training, dissemination, and implementation. and really thinking about at a workforce level, if we were going to bring enough people up to a skill level that could help a group of patients who tend to not respond to typical treatments or maybe don't respond as well, how would you do it? And so I've been thinking a lot about what is the essence, what are the mechanisms of change, and how does DBT sit relative to other approaches? And if you think about if you were really going to have the kind of sustainability you'd like to see so that, you know, a given clinical leader didn't have to retool, you know, every other year when their workforce turns over, you know, like what would it really take to create skill that would be sustainable? And how would you think about that? So I came at it from that perspective, thinking primarily at that sort of big picture. What is it that's effective? What do we know from the research about why it's effective? How does it sit with respect to other treatments? And then the other direction I went, Charlie, was I tend to think about at the nitty-gritty level, what does a given therapist and client have to do to solve problems? And to me, it's a lot like some of the best design thinking, like how do you actually solve certain types of very complicated problems. So the other way I've been thinking about DBT is sort of as a set of heuristics for problem solving. And I can say more about that, but that's the direction I went. Mm-hmm. How's that fit? Mm-hmm. How's that fit for you?
Well, you know, I came from so many directions. That fits with a lot of it. I think that no matter how I come to it, I mean, my own, the perspectives I come from completely color it. So that the perspectives I come from is that first I thought I was going to be a neurobiologist and mainly studying cell membranes in the nervous system and was totally excited about that and thought I would, you know, be doing that. And I was especially interested in how cells communicate to each other in tissue because they have to for incredible synchrony, like let's say a heartbeat. So I was studying that with electron microscopy up to a point. And then the next perspective I came at it from was, you know, without going into details about how I ended up from there into something as confusing and imprecise as what we do compared to that. you know, I did end up, you know, wanting to do psychotherapy and psychiatry with people with severe mental illness. And so I was really coming at it from just being gripped by, compelled by the stories that I would hear and this, what I would see and when I was a resident in psychiatry. And then psychoanalytic treatment. So that's a huge background. It's like a primary language for me. But it was a long time ago, in the 80s, when I was in psychoanalytic training and working mostly with Kernberg for years, day in and day out, and learning what later was called transference-focused psychotherapy. So I came at it from there, and where it overlaps with one of the things you were saying is what is the, of the different treatments, I think what's so different than 10 years ago is that there are, I mean, DBT, you know, it has 10-plus randomized controlled trials, which tells us not exactly what you do every minute, but it does tell you, it does give you a real start knowing that somewhere in the treatment package that we call DBT, something's working, but it's a huge package, so it's a lot of narrowing down to be done. We don't know what in implementation work is called the core components of the treatment. We know that the package works. So I've been so we know DBT works in many ways, but now we've been learning that several other treatments seem to work too, not the same level of evidence. But so I've been very interested, of course, myself in the psychodynamically oriented approach and DBT and what is the essence in common and what are the differences. But then also when you add in schema-focused therapy and mentalization-based therapy and basically skills training for people, and that these all of these models seemed and just sort of sound psychiatric clinical management as was studied by Shelley McMain and a group in Toronto. So you've got a lot of things are working. So I'm interested. One perspective I have is that. And I'll just say a little more about that to jump into that and then hear back from you about it.
Okay, great.
You know, it seems to me if you boil it down, and this is my other perspective, I mean, one of the other perspectives I come from is just day in, day out being a psychotherapist, and as you are, and training people to be psychotherapists. And it seems to me that one thing that was in common between different treatments that seem to work for borderline personality disorder is that you've got at the core a very, very important attachment, a relationship, usually capable of going in and out of being rather intense, usually marked by quite a bit of consistency in the therapies that work. There's a real coherence that links together a philosophy to a theory to strategies and other parameters that are set up in the treatment and what you're looking for minute by minute. I mean, there is a sense of coherence whether you're doing transference-focused therapy, DBT, or any of the others. You know, the therapist more or less has a principle-based idea of what they're doing in quite a few strategies in every case. And I think that in itself is huge compared to the person who's kind of going along without as much of a rudder. There's a lot of rigor in the application of every one of these approaches. You need rigor to counter the chaos. You need coherence.
Yeah, I would say the science, at least my read of the research, actually does support that. There's something about structure. So, like, if you look at treatment as usual, which I would say is maybe a little bit rudderless, not always, but often, versus treatment by experts or a structured protocol, then you tend to see better outcomes in those more structured protocols. So I think the evidence bears out that impression that you have.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened, I mean, when I had one foot in still practicing psychoanalytic object relations treatment, transference-focused therapy, and DBT at the same time, is that I felt like each of them came to the middle from a more pure model, let's say. I mean, a psychoanalytic model was really, Kernberg and other people moved it in the direction of adding more structure than usual, more of a contract. I mean, they moved to contracting, and Frank Yeomans did a lot of that work of kind of setting up the contract and really setting up the frame, and more than had been at the beginning of Kernberg's work and other psychoanalysts. And so I think the addition of structure, the addition of rules, the thematic priorities that structure the agenda of sessions a little bit like DBT's target priorities, all of these things were like psychoanalysis moving towards a behavioral approach. And I think CBT, which didn't seem to do the job by it as a pure model, moved towards an approach that has more validation, more flexibility, and interventions that would be familiar to people doing psychodynamically oriented work. So I think structure, I think coherence, I think there has to be a lot of flexibility, but you have to know what you're getting back to. And I do think that the research is in support of that, and having treatment targets. All of the current competitors for the treatment, I think, have tried to really specify targets the way a psychopharmacologist tries to specify, you know, really what are the symptoms we're aiming at, what are the targets. I think that DBT has that, but let me jump from that to your other.
Well, Charlie, before you jump, can I bring you back? So the other thing you said in passing was attachment.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that's a really interesting and not as well-researched area. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of common sense. There's some treatments that are more specifically focusing on that. But there is a recent study. Maybe you've seen this one, it was two papers that came out by Jamie Beddix and others in 2012, just a few months ago now, about the therapeutic relationship in DBT. Yeah, mm-hmm. Did you see that?
I didn't. Where was it?
Let's see. Yeah, let me just get this specific reference here.
One of the papers was in Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, mm-hmm. in Jamie Bedick's, B-I-D-I-C-S, Dave Atkins, Kate Comtois, and Marshall Linehan are the authors. Mm-hmm. And then they had a second follow-up one. But what was really interesting is they studied the therapeutic relationship in DBT and mm-hmm. in it was across the community treatment by experts also. Mm-hmm. And they had patients and therapists both rating their perceptions of the therapy relationship using mm-hmm. Lorna Benjamin's structural analysis of social behavior. But it's just a way of looking at various constructs that may be shaped. And what was really interesting to me is it turned out that the therapy relationships in DBT were more likely to be characterized by a blend of affirmation and control, so kind of a controlling protectiveness or a benign kind of controllingness in the service of giving autonomy. And that type of perception by the patient, that their therapist is both warm, protective, controlling, and giving of autonomy, was predictive of decrease in suicidal behavior. So I think that that's pretty interesting. And to me, it's a sort of the particular, it wasn't just a generically good therapeutic relationship. It was this blend of the therapist being perceived as being protective and controlling. Does that make sense?
You know, it leaves a lot for definition. I mean, it does make sense to me. I've thought that in various ways for quite a while. There was even at the, I don't know if you remember when Ed Sheeran worked with Marsha.
Exactly. It's a follow-up of his study.
I mean, and basically in Ed's study he did with Marsha while they were in the early days of doing therapy there, looking to see what kind of combination of therapist qualities happened in a session that predicted the least self-harm in the next week, and did that over time. And at least, it didn't have the kind of power that has been able to be used all over the place. But it was really interesting. It certainly matched what you're saying and what I also have experienced, which is this balance of having a session in which there isn't, the client experiences the therapist as warm and as imposing control. Just seems
and
to be
giving autonomy. Yeah.
Well, I didn't remember that from Ed's, but I actually wrote that down when you said it because I thought that was a little addition. God, it reminds me. I was just thinking, you know, with my kids being teenagers now, I just thought, you know, what do we do as parents? It's a little bit like, you know, we kind of help them find their place. We impose some control. We smile on them quite a bit. You know, we let them do their thing and we let go. I mean, we push them and we let go. And mm-hmm. it really is, I feel like, I just want to say this, and I think this is more the experience of somebody who came from my background than some people, though it's pretty common, I think, in people I've supervised. It's that part about imposing control and at the same time remaining not only warm, but also promoting autonomy, and also being creative is really hard with a moving target, with somebody who, I sort of think of this, I mean, when you were saying about learning to practice DBT as a therapist, it's so challenging because there's so much to learn. You're sort of system of your brain that takes in information and chops it up and rationalizes it and categorizes it, and it's disciplined and it's rigorous, and that whole part of the brain that really takes in information and can spit it out and can learn lists like DBT and protocols and put them together in sequence and do the diary card and do all the right things, you know, the whole thing, doing all the right things. That's a whole challenging thing to learn. And then to be using that in the first minute of the session, it's like learning to swim in the deep end. I mean, you're in the deep end the first second of the session with people sometimes with borderline personality mm-hmm. disorder, because they come in and they have such strong reactions to things, or you know, and they don't know you yet, or even once they know you. And so I feel like, God, it's like, take a deep breath. You got to know these things. As a trainee, as a therapist, you have to know these things. The way that a musician has to know how to play every note and every trill and make all the variations you need to make and read music. And then you have to let go of it. And I think that what they're saying in that paper is that you've got to have the control. And I think in DBT that means knowing the treatment and doing it as you should do it, as it's been laid out, based on aiming at targets and consistent with all the assumptions and agreements and so on. And you've got to be able to do it in a way where you're still emotionally responsive and aware every second. And you're spontaneous. And it's unbelievably challenging to do that. I think you get there, but it's how to get it there. I think DBT is one of the hardest treatments, certainly in the CBT repertoire, to learn because of that.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I would say, you know, just to I want to follow your lead here in terms of following what you were going to jump to next. But one thing you just said that was interesting to me, I want to make sure we circle back to, is how much you have to do it by the book. Because I think there's some real questions about that in terms of our perspectives on DBT. You know, what it is exactly that is the core mechanism isn't known, and how much fidelity is required is actually also not known.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'd love to come back to that. But where were you going to jump to next?
Well, let me say about that one of the things that I appreciate about DBT is that you do have to know all of those things, but you really don't know what are the core components. You don't know which interventions make the difference. But what I really liked from the beginning is that, and when Marcia would teach, that it's a protocol-based treatment where you pretty much have to know all those protocols, but it's a principle-based treatment. And so you really, how you use the protocols, like let's say even in your book, Kelly, this, you wrote a chapter on validation, and I think Alan Frazetti's done the same thing with this, and I have found my way the same place but wasn't as elegant as either one of you, about describing that validation as a in the world of the principle-based treatment of DBT, which I think really has a few principles, which is, thank God it just has a few principles, because, you know, then you can really keep your mind straight and you have different ways to move. But one of those principles is acceptance, I think, and probably mindful awareness and acceptance. And validation falls squarely in there, except when it doesn't. So that validation as an acceptance strategy is an acceptance strategy when it's an acceptance strategy. But there's other times that it's a change strategy. So it's really it's in the principles of change, of primarily behaviorism. And so you use, it's kind of like the function or the principles in some ways is the dominant experience for the psychotherapist, at least for me as a psychotherapist. I know all the strategies. I've practiced all the strategies. I know the skills. I know the protocols. But when I sit down with a patient, I don't think of all those things. I think of, I've got to push this person a little harder. And then I think, I've got to stop pushing so hard. I've got to just listen. I've just got to stop and listen here and open my mind. You know, and then I'm sort of practicing mindful awareness and acceptance. And then things get completely stuck back and forth. And then I think, God, I've got to tap into what we mean by being dialectical, sort of letting go of adhering to either side. And that's where my mind is. So I think that it's a complex treatment. We don't yet know what exactly works within it. Something does. And the principles, to me, are the guiding light. They're in my mind when I'm doing sessions. Yeah. I'm not always thinking, let's see, which of the 9 dialectical strategies am I going to use? I just think, I'm going to have to be dialectical now.
Yeah.
We're stuck.
Well, that you know, so I would take off from what you're just saying, because to me, Alan Frazetti's work in particular is supporting the idea that validation the ability to respond and strengthen what's adaptive in the other person's thinking or behaving or their emotions or situationally, you know, but that ability for another to validate, strengthen what's valid in another's response is pretty key. And the thing that makes me feel most excited is if you look at some of his work, and Perry's actually too, with their work with the Family Connections Program, mm-hmm. that has a really strong validation component to it, really training family members to be validating. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about that process that downregulates emotion, that reduces the number of cues that set off the intense dysregulation, and sort of switches the coercive, what can turn out to be a coercive cycle from both parties as they feel out of control and are trying to communicate and get their points across, that once you've got that more validating dynamic going by both sides of a communicate, you know, the partners, you can really end up changing the trajectory. So, like, Alan has some really nice studies at looking at the impact of validation on decreasing emotional arousal, of changing and improving outcomes. And then there's with paraprofessionals, right? Because the Family Connections Program is led by, you know, not expert people, but people who are certainly skilled with that. So I think validation is another one of these elements. Also, if you look at, remember the there was a comprehensive validation treatment offered in one of the treatment arms of a study looking at DBT for substance users, who also opiate, and so that was a straight validation treatment.
It was a small number of people, but still, even with the number, it was stunning, and I think it was surprising. I think it really, I think the in the history of DBT, if you were back there as I was, at in the let's say very early 90s, when Marcia would teach it, and she would teach about that you've got to do change and you've got to do validation or problem solving validation, her principle then, as she taught it, was kind of get away with as little validation as possible. Because this is a CBT treatment, and you just need enough grease to get the engine to go. You need enough validation. You need enough sugar on the pill so the bad medicine can go down. I mean, those were the metaphors she was using at the time. And in her lab, and maybe when you were there even, I mean, when you would rate acceptance versus change or the ratio of it in therapists, she was routinely herself rated as the highest ratio of change over acceptance. And I think that that went that way for quite a while. I mean, the idea being, look, the backbone of this treatment is CBT. It is targeting something. It is using evidence-based strategies derived from other treatments in order to go for it. And but you can't do that alone, so you have to add these other things in. But I think it's, I think the history of DBT in the last 20 years, there's been a real sort of theme of validation being looked at more and more carefully as something in its own right that reduces dysregulation, and sometimes in its own right, when you reduce dysregulation, the person actually starts moving forward, solving problems on their own. And so that is a change strategy. So, and I think Alan's work has done it. I think that the comprehensive validation study did it, because nobody, not one patient in that study, in on that arm, the comprehensive validation left the study. I mean, it was 100% retention, which I'm not sure there's ever been in the history of treatment of this disorder. And so it was quite something. And I know Marcia paid attention to that, really thought. And she sort of beefed up her whole understanding of validation and wrote a chapter that is kind of like the addendum to the official manual, I think.
I agree. And that book, Empathy Reconsidered,
So I think that there's more to come about that. I personally think that the role of dialectics, while in there, and it was put in there early, and it became, you know, the first name in the treatment's name, first word. I mean, and it's there all the time. the understanding of what that is still coming around the corner. It's one of the parts of the treatment that I think has made it possible to be creative and to sustain yourself and to tap into resources that we have in our own minds and in our own repertoires that are different than you would do with anything like straight CBT or even straight or sophisticated validation. The use of metaphor, not just specific metaphors, but the use of specific metaphors as a dialectical strategy is huge. But the experience of that, what, you know, really a creative understanding of what you're doing and how you're staying on track and how you're getting detoured and how you go down and how you get up and how you get up the mountain and how you deal with not having, you know, things falling out of your backpack as did on Boy Scout trips when I was a kid, and how to circle back. I mean, all of these things are so needed with this group and to be integrated somehow smoothly that I think that'll be, I'll be very interested. As you know, I've never been a researcher, and I'm interested if somebody starts taking up from a research perspective, what do we mean? If that's so key to the treatment, somebody's got to quantify that.
There's not much. I've been working on a manuscript that's supposed to go out here in the next couple of weeks, and I've been hard-pressed to find it. What you would think, you know, in terms of what the benefit, one of the benefits might be, is that dialectical thinking, like the process itself, you know, the very simple heuristic the therapist has, which is balance, acceptance, and change, you know, really that setting the therapist up to not become polarized and giving them ways of thinking that help them get unstuck, you know, in terms of all of the strategies, but the more fundamental position of that opposing truths can stand side by side. There's a really great author, Roger Martin, who talks about a dialectical tension of having two truths, two seemingly contradictory ideas, both being true, and being able to, the ability to hold that in your mind as being like having an opposable thumb. That
as
is
being
not
a what?
Some problem.
Yeah.
Having an opposable thumb, so that in fact solving some types of problems really means you have to really accept the limitations and simultaneously really reject the limitations, so that it's really the tension between the two that will give you the new solution. And to me, if there was a way to look, and I think for sure with our clients, you know, the ability to, you know, you didn't cause all your own problems and yet you have to solve them anyway, you're doing the best you can and yet you have to try harder, you know, like these abilities, I care about you, and therefore I'm not doing what you want. Like all of these tensions and the developing capability of holding them at the same time, that particular response to complexity, to conflict, I agree with you. I think it's actually quite an important part, but I wonder if it is. That's where we just don't have the evidence yet to suggest
one
way or the other.
No, it's true. We don't know. And I find it really, really helpful. And I've thought a lot about this and tried to teach it in various ways. But yeah, we don't know. I mean, that's empirical. But it does seem that there are. It is such a common experience in working with individuals with borderline personality disorder that you get stuck, and they get stuck, and the people around you get stuck, and the people around them get stuck, and it's just like you have. It really is that letting go of trying to push your way through the stuckness, letting go of just empathizing with it. But it's kind of like, how do you move? I mean, the first and most obvious one is the dialectic of pushing and accepting and pushing and accepting. And you might even call it back and forthness. And when you have that going at a certain pace, that sometimes will do the job, just if you really are skillful at that and you're responsive, you know. The hard thing about all these things is the very reason you get stuck is because you and the client are usually encountering some level of emotion dysregulation that makes you less effective and makes them less effective and makes you less effective as a duo, and you're stuck there. So actually, at that moment, to reach into yourself and find the creative impulse that puts together two opposing truths in a way that includes compassion is, you know, it's really amazing. And I think that it's written about all over the place in creativity, music, dance, and psychotherapy, certainly systemic psychotherapies, family psychotherapies, and every psychotherapy has their own edge on this, I think. But you know, from a, you know, to operationalize it, to catch it in a bottle, measure it, and see if you need it.
I don't know.
But I think that's one of the reasons this is such a complex therapy, is that we actually, it's a central part of the therapy, and we actually don't even know exactly.
Nor do we really train it. I think this is, to me, it would be fascinating to develop a very fun and yet rigorous training program that really facilitated the type of flexible thinking under duress. If you look at, for example, just how fighter pilots or others, you know, how they train so that their brains will continue to function and come up with solutions. I just feel like for therapists, if there's a way to train with arousal high to practice pivoting, to practice shifting, you know, all the different things, to generate a metaphor under there, or to at least remember one that you've heard somebody else say. We don't train that skill very often, I don't think.
I think in the past 6 to 12 months, I think I've done 4 workshops just called Being Dialectical, and been really trying to do just what you're saying. And sometimes for me, the way I figure things out is in training situations, because I feel I need to, it pushes me to the edge of articulating myself or demonstrating something. And usually the way I get there is, you know, have role play situations that just push me to the edge and then push other people to the edge and then see what you come up with. So, and then once in a while I feel like, there it was. That's it. That's it in almost pure form, even though there's 8,000 versions of it. What was that? You know, when in fact, I mean, there was somebody in a training that I did a few months ago, and we were doing a role play, and the person playing the client sat opposite me in front of everybody, and she said, I want to see how you use validation with this. And then she started being the client. And as the client was saying to me, I'm so upset with my friend. She's neglecting me. She's not having anything to do with me anymore. What kind of friend is this? And as a therapist, I said, what's going on? Tell me a little more about it. Well, you know, like her husband is dying. I mean, he has cancer and he's dying. But I mean, people do die. And she's still not paying much attention to me. And doing this, she's paying all of this attention to her husband. She's like not even returning calls. You know, and so the person who posed this to me was asking, how do you use validation with this? I find myself so upset. I can't validate. I said, well, let's just do a role play and see what I do as somebody who pretty much has a lot of DBT practice. But I found myself not validating. I mean, I jumped to what I think I'd consider a dialectical intervention. And I said, if she's someone who pays so much attention to people who are dying, why don't you tell her you're dying? And the person playing the patient looked at me and said, I mean, it was like she was stunned and said, what? Tell her I'm dying. I said, yeah, don't you think that would kind of grab her attention? She said, yeah, but that'd be terrible. Her husband is dying. I said, oh, right, of course. That's really important. She said, yeah, I know I'm a pain in the ass. And somehow she came out of that ridiculous statement of mine, she came out of it better. Sort of the way you say, like, you can learn that validation helps people regulate. But there's something about dialectical interventions, in other words, things that bring things together that are surprising. You'd also say that was an irreverent communication. But it was something, it was entering the paradox in a way, too. And she came out of it by saying, oh, no, my friend's husband is dying. I mean, she needs to pay a lot of attention to him. All right. That worked better than if I had said something straight. But what was that?
So,
to me, one of the reasons I'm still with DBT is that it does allow, it frames the possibility of having an intervention like that or like other kinds of using metaphors, extending and lemonade, all these things now and then in order to get out of log jams. But it's the part of the treatment I think nobody has yet systematized. So
I agree. It's not down to a sort of basic heuristic other than balance, acceptance, and change.
Right.
There's not much that's more sophisticated than that, I don't think. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, I was going to say. Well, the other thing I was thinking, you know, again, just what are the main mechanisms or, you know, what's the more recent research pointing to? The other thing it looks like is pretty clear is that for treating suicidal behavior, problem-solving therapies, any approach that's more likely to be problem-solving is helpful. And there was a recent really nice look at DBT skills in particular, and the predictiveness of clients who use more skills actually ending up less suicidal, and they ruled out other things. It was actually a really nice, I was just trying to find that reference for people, but I think that, and if you look at other, like the collaborative assessment and management of suicide and some of the other more structured approaches for suicide intervention and prevention, a problem-focused therapy is more likely to produce a reduction in risk for suicide. So I think that's the other thing that DBT, its problem-solving nature and its skills in particular look like they are also an active ingredient in DBT.
Well, you know, I would, when I started out in the comments at the beginning saying that, you know, one perspective that sometimes doesn't get represented is the perspective of clients or family members who are finding DBT not to be working the way they wish. And you know, people like you or me, I'm assuming people like me anyway, get a lot of referrals of people who come in and early on, like in the first session, say, look, I'll talk to you as long as you're not going to do DBT. And or something like that, and then you learn the story, and it's always a different story. But so I sat down in my area with two really articulate clients of the mental health system in Western Massachusetts, people who are part of really a advocacy group that's incredibly effective and helpful to me as a senior psychiatrist in that work. And I had an hour meeting with these two women who've been through a lot of DBT, because I wanted to hear, and I was considering, and still am considering, setting up a conference where we get consumer perspectives on DBT, and then talk about it. They said, and it was really great. I mean, they were very balanced. I mean, but what they said was pretty much mirrored what you just said, because their perspective was, before we criticize it, let me just say, one of them said, this has been DBT has saved my life. It's been incredibly helpful to me. And what's been helpful to me is the skills and the fact that somebody just keeps working with you to make it all work and to see you through things as opposed to just be there on a weekly basis. It's a different feeling. I feel like I've got this person on my side and they want me to learn these skills and they're teaching the skills. I don't always like the skills. I didn't like the group very much. But both of these people talked about how much that helped them, just the concrete stuff. So I have no doubt that that'll keep holding up, that the skills plus some coaching plus a certain attitude plus a certain longevity is really going to be helpful, and the other things might be helpful. What they really critiqued DBT for, which I think is pretty common, is I said, so what's the problem with it? One of them said, there's so many rules.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what do you mean rules? Well, you know, like, I came into this program, and then I had to give up my therapist that I've had for 3 years in order to get to learn these skills. That didn't seem right, but I did it because I really thought I should, and I thought my therapist wanted me to, so I actually gave up my therapist for a while and went with this other person. It was helpful, but God, couldn't they do better? And you know, you can't call after you've cut yourself, you know, or, you know, if you miss four times no matter what, you're out. Or you can't talk very much in depth about trauma yet because we haven't finished all of the stuff in stage one. Both of these women were saying, you know, those things, I'm sure they make sense from the people who designed the treatment. But God, it just seems like rule after rule after rule. And the way the way we were explained these things just felt like, you know, it's my way or the highway. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that enough to know this is not just sort of like a weird response.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've sent people to programs of DBT of real experts that I know, people that you and I both know and that are really good. And still these things. Hello?
Hello?
I'm still here. Yeah.
Are still experienced that way. And sometimes, you know, it's kind of like, how do you bring problem solving and skills into a relationship rather than force a relationship around these protocols.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it's that balance that also I think is a little bit hard to capture. I mean, all of this makes it obvious why it's taken well over a decade to have a good adherence rating measure and that it's very complex.
I'm really curious what other feedback your colleagues, your patients that were describing their experience had. Would they have other things that they noticed or that really stood out for them?
Well, you know, they did. It's funny that they didn't, when we talked further about it, they did not feel that their DBT therapies were characterized by any higher level of, you know, the phenomenology of validation, however you talk about it. They found other therapists that had been incredibly validating, nor did they especially attribute the validating atmosphere that DBT therapist tries to set up as having been key. But, you know, I think, you know, functional validation, the idea that a therapist recognizes that you need to learn these skills and really goes to bat with you in learning them and really is willing to get on the telephone with you and really suggest things to you. And meet with you occasionally at an odd time in order to help you get through an event by using skills. All of that was very huge. That was by far the biggest thing they talked about. They really felt like DBT has a lot of good things in it, but they didn't like the package as a whole. And they really articulated the problem-solving side of it. They didn't say a word about, you know, what I was talking about, the value of dialectics and things. I'm not sure that they would, but that may be more needed for the therapist, actually. But for the clients, I think they really appreciate that kind of like boot camp, but flexible boot camp, compassionate boot camp approach. And also that people don't hospitalize you instantaneously when you're suicidal, that people can sit tight while you go through something. That they articulated that because they are people who've been in the mental health system anywhere from 15 to 30 years between the two of them, and they have many times been hospitalized like a hair trigger when they thought it shouldn't have happened. So they liked about DBT that you can talk about those things.
That's great.
What do you think? Do those things sound like just what you would guess?
Yeah, and it definitely fits my experience with, I think the other that's been really hard for patients is the sheer amount of time to have to do a full comprehensive model that you have to be in skills group for 2.5 hours plus an individual therapy. Yeah. And so that's a lot of hours when you rack it up for a year. And I think, you know, people may get to the end and say, it was great. But I think it's such, also when you think about for adolescents, even if you shorten the treatment to 6 months, that's just a lot of time. And so I think that's another perspective that I've often heard. Yeah. You know, the rules, the kind of package element, the idea that it must be comprehensive, that idea to me is one that's a really interesting one. And again, I'm very open to going whatever direction you think. But when I think about, you know, as a person who's leading a clinic or who's making decisions at, say, a public administrator type, you know, when you're at that level and you're trying to decide, you know, what do you keep and what do you modify and how much do you do it exactly by the book, you know, if phone calls and phone coaching are very difficult to pull off in your system, would you let that go? And this way of sorting through those decisions, to me, the research evidence, we don't have the research evidence says you have to do it by the book, because we know these elements are the ones that have the impact. And yet, we also have a whole body of research that says clinical judgment, you know, us making kind of case-by-case decisions about what we keep and what we let go is not such a great plan, that our biases, our preferences as therapists, our own sort of weaknesses can end up with us letting go of what the effective ingredients are. So like one study showed that even very well-trained cognitive behavioral therapists will let go of using exposure-based procedures, and we know those are really, really effective. It's just they're emotionally
difficult.
They'll
let go under what conditions? What do you mean?
That they will tend to just drop that aspect of the treatment. So if you're treating somebody for an anxiety disorder, you'll let go of actually doing exposure. You'll do other elements. So I just, I think that there's a, you know, one way of approaching it is to say kind of more actuarial, that you're more likely to get the best outcomes if you do it exactly by the book.
And you know, I've been thinking, this is a really good point. I think it is an important perspective on DBT, is that there is the doing it exactly by the book, in a larger context where there are times you can't, because I mean, and that's what sort of was one of the generators of Linehan's development of DBT, is that she did a lot by the book and it didn't work, and so she modified. But I think that where she seems right, and it seems to be consistent with things that you're citing, is that you really want to do chunks by the book. You know, you got to, like, but I recently started with somebody where, I won't go into any detail, but there's almost nothing I can do by the book. It's just the nature of who this person is and where she's at in her life and how things have gone. There's there's no way I can go by any book. Of what somebody would say, oh, good, check off, you know, did this, check off this, check off this, check off this. Oh, now he's doing this CBT change procedure and he's doing it with the correct steps. There's no way I could be doing that now. So I'm doing a lot of other things, but I really think I can already see that there are certain pieces that are going to need, that are, I don't know if they'll need to be done, it's an overstatement, but I think are indicated to really do. And when I do them, I want to do them by the book. And it's sort of like, how do you do by the book and then not by the book? That's part of the dialectic. And rather than just give up the book or do it half by the book, which I think there's no evidence to show that doing exposure halfway, cognitive modification halfway, none of these things are, contingency management halfway is worse than no contingency management at all. So you really want to go by the book, and then what do you do when you can't, are these other things. And so I think that's another thing I've been just considering how do you, when you can't go by the book, what are you going by? I think you're going by principles, and you're keeping your eye on when can I do it by the book.
Hi, this is Jim Breeling.
Yeah.
We're 6 minutes to nine, and I just wondered if you would mind if I called your attention and people's attention back to three things that came up.
Sure.
Absolutely. Do it.
Okay. One is concerns the therapies working, and there certainly is data, but not only is there the Canadian study comparing DBT with kind of a well-implemented and carried-out case management, but there's a study in Europe that compared mentalization with something roughly along those lines. And again, I mean, there was, for all, you know, large number of variables, possible outcomes, and I think mentalization got one or two. But overall, there really was no difference. Both groups in Canada and Europe across most treatments approved. And it's like our friend down at Virginia Commonwealth University, good case management may do quite well, and in that regard, Brian Palmer later this fall in the series will be talking about general psychiatric management. And if that's true, if it's just really a well-organized, committed approach, and you kind of alluded to people liking that, that people were with them and staying with them and dealing with their problems and issues, that really opens up potential for on a very much more extensive and more rapid basis of getting people the care that would be helpful. That was just one thing on the variable. The other thing on the therapist turnover, in other areas, of, let's say in medicine, but in engineering and so forth, people really don't expect to do much training. They expect the people they hire to be properly credentialed both in knowledge and in performance. The local hospital, if it's hiring a cardiac surgeon, expects those knowledge and skills to come with them. And don't we have a problem in our training the therapist that they're not really up to snuff in knowledge and performance? So that you really can't, it then becomes very difficult to hire people and you have to train them. That strikes me as really, I mean, would you take somebody out of medical school and say, well, now that you're out practicing, at, you know, beyond residency and internship, now you'll really learn what to do. Starting from scratch, or we'll train you at that point. It just, you know, something seems wrong to me. And the other thing, we're talking on these methods, what are the variables? Are they symptom criteria, like acts of impulsivity or feelings of personal self-worth and so forth that are the real key things to directly target? And if so, how do DBT procedures or other procedures relate to those specific? Are the key variables other things? And if we knew those, it really opens up possibilities. You know what you have to change to show progress. And on depression, there's some progress in looking at MRIs and so forth for is this particular medication or treatment going to work or not, and being able to tell within a week or two or a few days, which is great rather than having to wait a couple of months. But also take social anxiety, a kind of a discovery. It's certainly not necessary or a sufficient variable for change, but not, if you will, overly assessing about the anxiety-raising social situation does have a very robust correlation with the degree of social anxiety. So if you once you take that, the question is, how do we change it? And you're not bound by a therapy, so an investigator at University of Southern California has come up with a computer-trained thing, procedure that probably works very well with maybe 40% of the people. And just think of the cost implications. Here's something quick, easy, enjoyable to do, and 40% isn't bad in psychiatry for outcomes. And if that doesn't work, then you can dig into other things. But you know, once you know what variables you want to change, it really opens up the possibilities and also what's really relevant and what's not relevant. The other thing was the adherence to the therapy you talked about. And I can't help thinking, because of interactions that I've been having, there's a bunch of things. Boy, do we really want people, the medical and care staff in hospitals, not to be washing their hands as they go from patient to patient, given the high rate and seriousness of hospital infections? Do we or do we not want surgeons and their teams to be very careful in following the checklist and procedures for the number of sponges inserted and the number of sponges pulled out, and so forth? There's a number of things. Boy, that auto mechanic, when you do auto work and you're doing brake work, you really want to follow the protocol that you've closed all the valves and filled the brake fluid and got the air bubbles out. Otherwise, things aren't going to work well. They're going to fail. And you really want to adhere to those with great faithfulness.
Right. But, Jim, you know, it seems to me that...
Anything.
What?
It almost seems like anything goes.
Well, you know, it still is way more like that than any one of us want it to be. I mean, I think it's not just that way of working. I think that there are still so many candidates for the, you know, what are the core components of the treatment? What really are the change mechanisms? I mean, if we knew, I mean, if we could go back to an era where maybe somebody would give, 15 things for pneumonia and one of them was a penicillin tablet, but they didn't know yet that the penicillin tablet is the thing that made the difference, then you know, it'd be pretty confusing what you should do. I still think we're there. I hate to say that because I know that the treatment developers are brilliant and they've been really laying it out. But I've practiced this as long as most people and with a lot of diligence, and I enter into a new treatment still not knowing for sure. I mean, I've learned a lot from treatments. I've learned really that I have to get to the point where there are some links in the chain of their behavior that have to do with dysregulation of emotions, phobias, social phobias, shame, trauma, that I know by now I'm going to end up there, and grief every time, and loneliness. So, you know, you want to develop things to target those, and I don't think we're quite there yet, but we're going in that way. But I don't think you can start having the specifications like washing your hands between patients where there's overwhelming data for that, or leaving a sponge in somebody. I don't know the data on there. I'm guessing that's pretty good data. You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But I don't think we have that many things. Doing a diary card in DBT is a big deal. Is it critical? You know, balancing acceptance and change, is it critical? Problem solving with this. So I think smart people are figuring this out, but it still seems we have a long ways to go. I also, speaking a long ways to go, it's 9 or just past.
Right.
Jim, it was great to have you jump in. Kelly and I have been doing this several times. And it's just, don't you find, Kelly, it's great to have another voice suddenly jump in and point out something?
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Very interesting and stimulating session. And we'll look forward to your next appearance by voice. And about a month to carry this forward, and to remind everybody, next week at Sunday at 8:00 to 9:00, we will have Jenny McPhee from the University of Tennessee about borderline mothers and their children from toddlers to adolescents. Fascinating data with rich implications for prevention.
And you have other fabulous people coming up. I just want to—I've looked ahead at your schedule. It's
looks great.
It really looks interesting. So thanks for you and Perry getting this going.
Well, and thank you and Kelly for supporting us and coming back again this year. The rave reviews, we can't say enough about. I'll forward you some of the questions and statements that came in. Is that okay?
Absolutely. Send us everything, the rave and the not-so-rave reviews and the questions and the answers.
Okay,
yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks,
everybody.
Have a great night.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.